In a moment, I'll be taking you through a number of poems about war, which are making their extraordinarily... Maybe we can divide them into two packs. Can we divide it up into two batches? Speed it up, thanks. So we'll be going through the poems on this handout here, which is coming round to you. Let me just say, while we're waiting for the handout to reach you, this actually takes you up to a very recent point. In 2003, the most recent of those poems was published. So it goes somewhat beyond the catchment of LMW. I'm brazenly going to claim that there is a sort of intrinsic excuse for that, which is that the post-Second World War period inaugurated about 40 years or 50 years, depending how you count it and which wars you include, of what have come to be known as proxy wars, the wars that were fought as a sort of sideshow around the world in order to avoid fighting a big war between the opposing ideologies that clashed during the Cold War. And those, of course, didn't stop conveniently in 1960 just to please the parameters of literature and the modern world at Warwick. So our poem selection isn't going to stop at 1960 either. So let me just ask for your forgiveness for having awkwardly elbowed out of the box. Can everybody hear me? Is this okay? Right. I think the gentleman who was setting the levels is now gone, so if it's not okay, I'll have to fling myself upon your mercy. How are we doing with the handouts? Who can't see one now? All right. I'll just start, in that case, by filling in a little background to our first poet. We're going to begin with the writer who took for himself the pen name of Paul Celan, C-E-L-A-N. His name was actually Anchel, so it's a sort of anagram of his surname. And he was born into the German-speaking minority in Romania. It's a minority which virtually has ceased to exist, but that has no connection historically with the reasons why his family ceased to exist. His parents died in an extermination camp in the Nazi gas chambers in the Second World War. But the German-speaking minority has found itself under pressure to up sticks and leave Romania in the last 20 years, and that's what most of them have done. So there's been a tremendous rapid erosion of that minority that was left in Romania in the meantime. That was where Paul Celan came from. He himself survived, but like many Jewish writers after the Second World War, after the Nazi genocide, he found himself burdened with immense feelings of guilt by virtue of having survived. This sense of being burdened and of the impossibility of saying in mere words what it was that he felt needed to be said drove him further and further towards silence. George Steiner, the wonderful critic, has written very eloquently on the path of Paul Celan towards silence in his poetry. And in his life, he found it in 1970. He took his own life in Paris. So a suicide, not the only suicide of that kind, as you know. The poem that you have on your handout is by a very long way his most famous poem, and one could say really the most celebrated, if that's the word, Holocaust poem. It has in the original German, and one of the first paradoxes to think about is that he chose, in spite of everything, to write in the language of the people who had the lives of his parents on their conscience, but he chose German as his language for poetry. And in the German, it has a tremendously incantatory, hypnotic feel to it, this poem does. It begins with three troches, Schwarze Milch der Frühe. And that has a tremendously heavy sound to it by itself. And then there's an invisible caesura there. He uses no punctuation. And then it modulates into a rather peculiar meter, which those of you who are fetishist about prosody may know of, the Amphibrach. This is a meter which goes from an unstressed to a stressed to an unstressed syllable in a foot. Be bumpy, be bumpy. And when you string them along together, the effect is poised between the anapest and the dactyl. And the anapest, as we know, conventionally has this sense of waltzing. Dee-dee-dum, dee-dee-dum, dee, yeah? And the dactyl goes da-da-da, da-da-da, da-da-da. It keeps on falling, has that elegiac sound. And that terrible paradox that you can achieve with a very judicious use of the Amphibrach is what Paul Celan trades on brilliantly in this poem, that it's forever rising, and he has this little motif in the poem of Jews compelled to play music in the death camps, and at the same time falling, the terrible elegiac awfulness of the subject matter. There are a lot of translations of this poem into English. Here's one by an American scholar and poet and translator, John Felsteiner. Death fugue. Black milk of daybreak. We drink it at evening. We drink it at midday and morning. We drink it at night. We drink and we drink. We shovel a grave in the air. There you won't feel too cramped. A man lives in the house. He plays with his vipers. He writes when it grows dark to Deutschland. Your golden hair, Marguerite. He writes it and steps out of doors, and the stars are all sparkling. He whistles his hounds to come close. He whistles his Jews into rows, has them shovel a grave in the ground. He orders us, strike up and play for the dance. I won't read the whole poem out. I won't read any of these poems out, I think, in their entirety. We don't have the time. But I'll just skip towards the close. Black milk of daybreak, we drink you at night. We drink you at midday. Death is a master aus Deutschland. We drink you at evening and morning. We drink and we drink. Death is ein Meister aus Deutschland. His eye is blue. He shoots you with shot made of lead, shoots you level and true. A man lives in the house, your goldenes Haar, Margarete. He looses his hounds on us, grants us a grave in the air. He plays with his vipers and daydreams. Der Tod ist ein Meister aus Deutschland. Dein goldenes Haar, Margarete. Dein aschenes Haar, Sulamit. Felsteiner has done something very interesting in his translation. He's brought bits of that original German back into the poem, as if to say we cannot wipe out the authorship. Yes?
Are there any more handouts?
Oh, excuse me. Are there any handouts left? We've got one. There are some more over there. If there are any, does anyone still not have a handout? Someone over there as well. There's one for here. Thanks. He's bringing bits of the original German back into the poem as if to remind us here is the authorship of the crime we're talking about. Those names, those are worth pausing over. Margarete. For some reason that I can't quite fathom, he's begun by putting that into French. That's something that you may find an occasion to talk about if you discuss translation. But Margarete is the name of the woman in Goethe's Faust, the great innocent whom Faust leads to perdition. This name, through that, has a sort of iconic status in German culture. And she is used here to stand for the golden-haired German innocent and contrasted with the archetypal Jewish name, Shulamit. So we have the ashen hair of Shulamit. You heard, I'm sure, even in the English translation, something of that extraordinary rhythm which is there. And you can see that in words like ashen and golden, very economically, I'm going to say the iconic functions are deployed in this poem. It's not just as simple as saying the stereotypes, I think. This isn't, properly speaking, if you like, a poem of war. This is a poem of genocide. The Second World War, of course, produced marvelous poems, which I'm not going to discuss here, but if you want to look back to a British writer like Keith Douglas or an American writer like Randall Jarrell, you'll find extraordinary poems there about combat. But it's, I think, no exaggeration to say that Celan's Fugue of Death, or Death Fugue, is the single most celebrated poem to have come out of the Second World War. Now, the poems we're looking at here are written from different perspectives. And the thing that is more or less common to them is that they're not primarily the perspective of the combatant. There are all sorts of other perspectives that are involved in warfare, and increasingly, warfare is beginning to be, as it were, a kind of spectator event. And we follow it often live on our television screens. We will come to that presently. In the 1950s, of course, people followed it principally through their newspapers. And the poem I'm going to move to next is by a New Zealander, not a poet on everybody's lips, although I believe he should be more familiar than he is, R.A.K. Mason. The first major proxy war of the Cold War, in other words, the first war fought out between communism, the Soviet bloc, and its satellite states on the one hand, and Western or other nations supported by the United States in their attempt to resist communism on the other hand. The first of these major proxy wars was the one in Korea, beginning in 1950. And as you know, of course, we're still living with the consequences because to this day, Korea is a partitioned, divided nation with a demilitarized zone and regular flare-ups of hostilities. Now, Douglas MacArthur was a celebrated U.S. general of the Second World War. We associated his name particularly with his promise to return to the Philippines, which he did as the war moved into its final phases in the Pacific. He was the supreme commander of the United Nations forces in Korea, fighting against the communist North. And Mason saw this report of something that apparently MacArthur said. General MacArthur looked down on the bodies of four young Korean soldiers. "That's a good sight for my old eyes," he said. Mason was outraged by this. "I have known old eyes that had seen many more aspects of warfare than this man has seen. Eyes that had looked on Gallipoli, or the keen edge of battle with the Boer, or even, in older war, had known Balaclava and the mutiny's evil score. Such eyes, as I've known them old, have always been eager to see spring flowers and the youth who mean mankind spring after war's winter. Never before have I known of anyone whose old eyes rejoice to see young men lying dead in their own land. Never have I known one who of his own choice follows up the machines of death to take his stand over the slain and in a quavering voice declaim his joy at youth dead beneath his hand. That sonnet, we think sonnet, of course, and the sonnet was claimed as a vehicle for the poetry of war by the writers of the First World War. You need only think of Wilfred Owen's Anthem for Doomed Youth. That's a sonnet. So its heritage as a poem of love was displaced long before 1950, of course. But there is still a grimness to using this pretty little contrivance of the 13th century, where the Italians originally devised it as a celebration of love, for something as terrible as this sort of subject. And the writers are conscious of that. Richard Wilbur, at the height of the Vietnam War, wrote an address to Lyndon B. Johnson, which said how terrible it was that a nation founded by men like Thomas Jefferson should live to impose its cattle brand, as he puts it, on smaller nations. And he wrote that also in the form of a sonnet. And if we think back in terms of poetry, we remember that writers like Wordsworth and Milton, tracing the line back, think of Milton's sonnet on the massacre in Piedmont, or Wordsworth's sonnet to Toussaint Louverture after the uprising in Haiti, as we now call it. These are sonnets on tremendously serious, political, violent, warlike subjects. So there is a lineage there, and that is something that Mason is taking up in this poem. So there is a poem of the Korean War, but most of the time, of course, the Cold War, as the name suggests, wasn't actually being fought. And the poets, like everybody else, found themselves in a position of responding to something which expressed itself only as fear of what might happen. And we associate names like Cuba, for example, with the crises which focused that fear and brought it to the point of thinking, well, our annihilation might be imminent, because the massive nuclear armaments, the stockpiles that were being built up on both sides through the 50s and, of course, continuing through the 60s and 70s, threatened warfare on a scale that posed what came to be known by a horrible acronym, MAD, MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. I have two poems on this handout which are about that condition of awaiting the annihilation that's to come and the speculation and the fear and so on that goes with it. And both of them were written at a time just before Cuba, as it happens, just before that massive crisis. One is by Peter Porter, magnificent Australian poet who lived most of his life in London and died there just last year, and the other by Richard Wilbur, an American poet who saw military service in the U.S. Army during the Second World War. He was born in 1921. He's still alive, so he'll be 90 this year, it occurs to me. We should all get together and just all of you spare one penny from the cost of that ball, and we can club together and send him a birthday card for his 90th birthday. Peter Porter's poem is ironic at the expense of the civil defense instructions that used to be issued. A lot of this will seem to you laughable, but we know of historically documented and perfectly factual examples of things which now can only make us smile or laugh. We know, for example, that at nuclear tests in the Pacific, sailors were told that when the blast occurred, they should hold a paper bag over their heads. Yeah? And then? What sort of protection is this? They were just a few miles from the blast. There are some of the most extraordinary things. So what looks to you in this poem like ridiculous satire is only just a little over the top. Your attention, please. The Polar DEW has just warned that a nuclear rocket strike of at least 1,000 megatons has been launched by the enemy directly at our major cities. This announcement will take 2.25 minutes to make. You therefore have a further 8.25 minutes to comply with the shelter requirements published in the Civil Defense Code section Atomic Attack. Especially shortened mass will be broadcast at the end of this announcement. Protestant and Jewish services will begin simultaneously. Select your wavelength immediately according to instructions in the Defense Code. Do not take well-loved pets, including birds, into your shelter. They will consume fresh air. Leave the old and bedridden. You can do nothing for them. Remember to press the ceiling switch when everyone is in the shelter. Set the radiation aerial. Turn on the Geiger barometer. Turn off your television now. Turn off your radio immediately the services end. At the same time, secure explosion plugs in the ears of each member of your family. Take down your plasma flasks. Give your children the pills marked 1 and 2 in the CD green container, then put them to bed. Do not break the inside airlock seals until the radiation all clear shows. Watch for the cuckoo in your Perspex panel, or your district touring doctor rings your bell. If before this your air becomes exhausted or if any of your family is critically injured, administer the capsules marked Valley Forge, red pocket in number 1 survival kit for painless death. Catholics will have been instructed by their priests what to do in this eventuality. This announcement is ending. Our president has already given order for massive retaliation. It will be decisive. Some of us may die. Remember, statistically, it is not likely to be you. All flags are flying, fully dressed on government buildings. The sun is shining. Death is the least we have to fear. We are all in the hands of God. Whatever happens, happens by his will. Now go quickly to your shelters. A lot of things could be said about this poem. One that needs pointing out is that, of course, the practicalities that are being satirized here were not actually in place. The only country in the world that ever actually constructed sufficient shelters to house all of its population in the event of nuclear attack was Switzerland, believe it or not. They actually did it. And, of course, they're used as underground garages and so on. But they managed the feat. But no other country did that. And all this business about the pills that you've been provided with and so on, that is his invention. This is not actually literally true. Needless to say, the references to God are intended with a heavy satire. I suppose there must have been a point where people stopped believing that this or that military campaign was seriously done with the blessing of God. At the very latest, the First World War, one would like to think, ended that. So there is very powerful satire in that as well. But that poem was first published in, I think I'm right in saying 1961. It may have been 1960. So it's just before the Cuban Missile Crisis, which brought the world to the very, very brink of nuclear war. And in the same year, 1961, Richard Wilbur published his book, Advice to a Prophet, the title poem of which also addresses the difficulty of bringing home to people exactly what it is that the population of the world is confronting. When you come as soon you must, to the streets of our city, mad-eyed from stating the obvious, not proclaiming our fall, but begging us in God's name to have self-pity, spare us all word of the weapons, their force and range, the long numbers that rocket the mind. Our slow, unreckoning hearts will be left behind, unable to fear what is too strange. Nor shall you scare us with talk of the death of the race. How should we dream of this place without us? The sun mere fire, the leaves untroubled about us, a stone look on the stone's face. And so it goes on. The invitation to imagine the world without humanity, that is the crux that Richard Wilbur is getting at here. And he does it in a remarkably polished stanza. The form of the poem is itself a form of irony, isn't it? To create such a beautiful, accomplished, rhetorically polished work of art about annihilation, about the end of everything that we care for, the end of beauty, the end of the natural world, and so on. The poets write these poems with a very, very profound sense of the irony of what they're doing. There's a reference in Wilbur's poem, if you look to the end of to the beginning of the sixth stanza. He imagines that every torrent will burn as Xanthus once. And that is a reference to the Iliad, where Hephaestus is commanded by his mother to burn the trees on Xanthus' banks and set the very river on fire. Yeah. Set the very river on fire. Well, of course, Homer's Greeks were in no position to do that. Richard Wilbur knows that there are materials used in modern warfare that will burn very nicely, thank you, in the water, and will, so to speak, set even the river on fire. So he's going back to our oldest great epic of warfare, and he's implanting the reference to it in there, knowing that actually the world has learned a trick or two about war in the meantime. So these writers, what are they doing? What are they up to? We began with Paul Celan as a survivor, writing, of course, a great lament. And then we looked at a writer producing a statement of moral outrage that any older person could conceivably be overjoyed to behold young dead. And now we have two poems which are about the prospect of nuclear annihilation. Just think of the helplessness of the poet who's thinking to himself, here we have Washington, here we have the Kremlin. The war of words and the proxy wars, they're going on the whole time. What am I doing with my typewriter? Very soon, there was a bigger war in store, and that was the Vietnam War. As you know, that went on for a decade. It threatened to expand well beyond Vietnam. And it was the Vietnam War, rather than Korea or any of the other big explosive incidents of the Cold War, such as the building of the Berlin Wall, such as the Soviet invasion of Prague. It was the Vietnam War that focused protest and, of course, protest poetry. And two of our poems in the selection here deal with Vietnam, and they do it in rather different ways. We have Howard Nemiroff in 1973, and we have, this is not actually in sequence in your handout, but later on, we have Yusuf Komunyakaa, writing as a veteran after the end of the war, more than a decade after the end of it, visiting the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. Now, the Nemiroff poem, I should say that Nemiroff, like Richard Wilbur, was a combatant in the Second World War. He was an Air Force pilot. And he knew what war was like. And he looked around him at all the protest poems that were being written and the marches and demonstrations. And I'm afraid to say he, possibly rightly, thought it's not making any impression. And that, of course, is the big question that must be over protest poetry, political poetry, war poetry. What is it for? Is it just a safety valve? Is it just a way of letting off steam for the writer? It's a big question. It's a big question. We know of some examples. For example, Robert Lowell, reading his poetry at the march in 1975 at the Pentagon. The scene is wonderfully described in Norman Mailer's novel, The Armies of the Night. Robert Lowell gave a tremendously powerful reading. He put all the force of his personal reputation and his authority behind the anti-war protest movement in the States. So you can say that poetry of this kind helps to mobilize opinion. Did it bring the war to an end sooner than it might have ended? Probably not. That, at any rate, is the sort of conclusion that Howard Nemiroff would have come to. Here's his poem on being asked for a peace poem. Here is Joe Blow the poet sitting before the console of the giant instrument that mediates his spirit to the world. He flexes his fingers nervously. He ripples off a few scale passages. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? And resolutely readies himself to begin his poem about the war in Vietnam. This poem, he figures, is a sacred obligation. All by himself applying the immense leverage of art, he is about to stop this senseless war. So Homer stopped that dreadful thing at Troy by giving the troops the Iliad to read instead. So Wordsworth stopped the revolution when he felt that Robespierre had gone too far. So Yevtushenko was invited in the Times to keep the Arabs out of Israel by smiting once again his mighty lyre. Joe smiles. He sees the Nobel Prize already and the reading of his poem before the General Assembly, etc., etc., etc. Okay. We get it. So that is the point at which the political poet gives up, you might say. Gives up, except that if you turn the page of Nemiroff's collected poems, you find a couple of wonderfully barbed and very pithy anti-war poems. He was writing the two, so to speak, back to back, maybe even on the same day. It is the classic problem of poetry, is it not? It's not only that it has become a minority art, it is also that, in the words of W.H. Auden, poetry makes nothing happen. Yeah? It cannot expect to have a forceful, direct impact and influence in the world of actual happening. And yet, because we are creatures of language, and because poetry is one of the things we do with language, we continue to make poems about war, as we have done since humanity crawled out of its caves. The war in Vietnam was not confined to Vietnam. It spilled over into Cambodia. Cambodia at that time was, and I'm talking about the early 1970s, in 1953, Cambodia had achieved independence from French colonial rule, and it had become a constitutional monarchy under Prince Norodom Sihanouk. One of his, I think his brother, appears in this poem, and that's Norodom Chantarangzi. Norodom is the family name. Sihanouk was deposed in 1970 by a man named Lon Nol in a military coup, and that government was sympathetic to the United States, but very quickly faced a rising from the communist-oriented Khmer Rouge. And it's in the context of those struggles in the early 1970s between the Khmer Rouge and Lon Nol's U.S. sympathetic government that this poem is set. And here it's not written in the voice of somebody, as it were, at long distance, following the events at home from the newspapers or television. This is written in the voice of the war correspondent. James Fenton is celebrated as a poet, as a journalist with many strings to his bow, and for several years was himself a war correspondent in Vietnam and Cambodia, and for that matter, he also covered the revolution that ended the reign of President Marcos in the Philippines. In Vietnam in 1975, he actually hitched a ride on a North Vietnamese tank as it went into the gates of the abandoned American embassy compound. So that's how close he was to the action. He was there. This poem here, we have to assume, is dated to around about 72 or 3. It's when the fighting between the military junta, as I said, U.S. sympathetic, and the Khmer Rouge, communist, is at its peak in Cambodia. And again, you can see it's 2 pages long. I can't possibly read all of this out now. But it's an extraordinarily vivid portrayal of what you might call a picnic on a battlefield. When His Excellency Prince Norodom Chantarangzi invited me to lunch on the battlefield, I was glad of my white suit for the first time that day. He gives us descriptions of the food they eat, the frogs' legs, pregnant turtles, their eggs boiled in the carapace, marsh irises in fish sauce, the Napoleon brandy that they're drinking, and the empty bottles piling up, which apparently they nicknamed dead soldiers. And he tells us something about the people who are there. And if you move down to the lower part of the first page, "I wanted to talk to the prince. I wish now I had collared his aide, who was Salot Sa's brother. We treated him as the club bore. He was always boasting of his connections, boasting with a head shake or by pronouncing of some doubtful phrase. And well, he might boast. Salot Sa, for instance, was Pol Pot's real name. The APCs fired into the sugar palms but met no resistance." Pol Pot, it's possible that I even need to explain who Pol Pot was, but the leader of the Khmer Rouge, they came to power in the mid-70s. They then perpetrated ideologically driven mass killings. Some of you may have seen the film The Killing Fields, which was based on those mass killings. And the country to this day, of course, is still recovering from its great trauma. Pol Pot must be mentioned with all the other great dictator murderers of the century. Look how it goes on. Over the page, on the next page, Fenton reports a conversation with Pol Pot's brother, whom he nicknames the Jockey Cap, and then goes on to what he thought would happen. Middle of the page, "In those days, I thought that when the game was up, the prince would be far, far away, in a limestone faubourg on the promenade at Nice, reduced in circumstances but well enough provided for. But we were always wrong in these predictions. It was a family war. Whatever happened, the principals were obliged to attend its issue. Lots of interesting things here going on. The principals were obliged to attend its issue. He's quite right about this particular prince. We don't even know for sure when exactly Borodom Chantarangzi died. We think 1976, but we can't even get closer than the year. That's how impassable Cambodia became in the mid-70s. But he was one of the many casualties of this civil war. So he didn't get away to Nice or anywhere else. Notice the "we." We were always wrong in these predictions. The best place to get a flavor of who's meant by that "we" is actually the opening chapter of a novel called The Honorable Schoolboy by John le Carré. So I don't know if any of you read modern spy thrillers, but that book is... the opening chapter gives you a gaggle of journalists, war correspondents, who are doing the war correspondent thing, which is covering the war in Vietnam from a journalist's bar in Hong Kong. So they're well away from the fighting, and there they are having their journalistic life. And the conversation is this sort of conversation. We were always wrong in these predictions. That's what war correspondents do. They're not normally the James Fenton kind, riding around on the backs of North Vietnamese tanks. Normally, they're trying to keep their distance. Things, as we know, have changed. We have words like embedded now, but even then, there are strict protocols governing what kinds of dangers they can be exposed to. But that "we" means we correspondents, we who thought we were in the know and knew what would happen. So you notice that the poems that we're reading here, they're not combatants' poems. And you might say that there's a question behind that, which is the question of, if you like, authenticity. One of the things that changed the map of war poetry was the sense in the First World War that the poems that were coming out of the war were coming straight from the trenches. They were being written by people like Sassoon, Ivor Gurney, Wilfred Owen, etc., who were there. Some of them died in the war, others survived it, but they were there. They knew exactly what they were writing about. Various things have made it more and more difficult for that sort of poetry to be written. The first thing to remember is that the First World War, like the Second World War, ended up being a mass conscription war. So everybody was sucked into it. Whereas these proxy wars were normally being fought by the professional armies, so well-educated people who could write poetry to a certain standard were statistically, should we say, less likely to be at the front. That's one thing. But another thing is that the wars became faster and faster. And if you think of the Gulf War of 1991, just a few weeks, of course there are other wars that were faster still. Think of the Six-Day War of Israel in 1967. But the sheer speed with which conflict happens, a particular engagement is sometimes over in just a very, very few minutes. Yeah? So there are all sorts of factors which are mitigating against the writing of poetry by combatants. This isn't a universal truth, and we have at the moment, he's not in your handout, but we have an extraordinarily good American poet by the name of Brian Turner, who has been getting a lot of attention on both sides of the Atlantic for his poetry about the Iraq War that's just over. So this isn't an iron rule, but it's become much more the case that poetry about war is written by those who are, in fact, a long way away from the action. I'm going to let you debate in your seminars whether that raises issues of authenticity or not. You might say, for example, does it matter whether Tennyson was present at the charge of the Light Brigade. Does that mean he can't write about it? Does it matter that Shakespeare was not present when the forces of Mark Antony met the forces of Brutus and Cassius? Does it matter that Homer may have been six people or may not have existed, as it were, at all, let alone being present at Troy? These questions of authenticity are interesting to discuss, but I'm going to leave them with you and move on to the next poem by an Australian writer, John Forbes. I said that the use of sonnets for war poetry had become an interesting double-edged sword, because it uses something which began its life as a vehicle for the expression of love to talk about war. And here's someone who's quite bold and simply calls his war poem Love Poem. And you'll quickly see why. This is the Gulf War of 1991. Spent tracer flex Baghdad's bright video game sky as I curl up with the war in lieu of you, whose letter lets me know my poems show how unhappy I can be. Perhaps. But what they don't show, until now, is how at ease I can be with military technology. E.g., what matching their feu d'esprit, I classify the sounds of the Iraqi AA, the thump of the 85 mil, the throaty chatter of the Quad ZSU-23. Our precision-guided weapons make the horizon flash and glow, but nothing I can do makes you want me. Instead, I watch the West do what the West does best, and know, obscurely, as I go to bed, all this is being staged for me. It's become one of the platitudes by now of sociological commentary on our relationship with television that it's an extremely solipsistic relationship. And we think that what comes from the television is for us. This is for me. And that relationship is then universalized almost regardless of the content, so that it's possible to be in the position of the consumer of the media image watching the TV live broadcast of the bombardment of Baghdad. And as John Forbes says there, thinking this is being staged for me. He's, as it were, made a point of it. He's caricatured the sense. I don't suggest that you sit there consciously thinking, ah, this war is mine. It's not quite what's meant. But that subliminal sense of possession that one enters into when embracing the media image, that's what he's caught perfectly in, that idea that it's being staged for me. Now, he's put that in the context of a poem that has other things on its mind. Clearly, a love affair that is not going quite right. It's not working out smoothly. And in the midst of that, he's got the TV on and he's watching the bombardment of Baghdad, and he's distinguishing the sounds of the different kinds of anti-aircraft fire and so on. And the question that comes to us as we go back to the title is, what sort of love is this? Is it the love that's been negotiated by letter, or is it the love of self that's being articulated through his infatuation with the idea that the war is somehow being done for me? Is it something even more horrible? Is it a love of war itself, as long as it's safely there, where I can watch it on television? The poem, actually, simple as it is, has quite a lot of layers to it like that. I'm going to finish, I might say, where we came in. And that is to say, with the Jewish experience, we began this very quick overview with a poem about the genocide in the Nazi death camps. We're going to end it with a poem that dates from the Second Intifada, and it describes the killing in September 2001. And the poem was published in 2003. And bear in mind the sort of arc that we've traveled here, because Paul Celan's poem was written in the same year that the State of Israel was founded. And the State of Israel and its foundation had, of course, the sympathy of the world in the late 1940s, because the world knew what had just been done to millions of Jews. This poem, and I should say it's written by a Jewish writer, is on a much more difficult subject, and that is the problem that the Jewish state has itself got blood on its hands by now. And this poem here includes the thought of consuming hostilities on the television. It includes the thought of the pointlessness of the poet simply sitting down and writing another poem about it. All of that is included. Where does it get us? The author doesn't know, you don't know, I don't know. There's no simple answer. That's, in a sense, the point. The man is a teacher of classics at Tel Aviv University. He's one of the most distinguished living Israeli poets, and he wrote a whole series of blistering poems attacking his own country's government at the time when a lot of Palestinians, many of them civilians, were falling casualty to the Israeli forces. Rosh Hashanah. Even after the murder of the child Muhammad on Rosh Hashanah, the paper didn't go black. In the same water in which the snipers wash their uniforms, I prepare my pasta and over it pour olive oil in which I've browned pine nuts, which I cooked for 2 minutes with dried tomatoes, crushed garlic, and a tablespoon of basil. As I eat, the learned Minister of Foreign Affairs and Public Security appears on the screen, and when he's done, I write this poem. For that's how it's always been. The murderers murder. The intellectuals make it palatable. And the poet sings. I'm going to leave you with the thought that, well, the poets will continue to sing. We want them to do that. That's what they do. But must the intellectuals make it palatable? That's a thought for you.